They are to withdraw when the inner prompting bids them do so, when the inner need for such refuge becomes pressing and when the outer circumstances allow it. All aspirants should use these intervals to learn more about what they really are and what life really is. Then they are to return to worldly duty, plunge into worldly activity and there test their knowledge, practice their discrimination and express their ideals. They need to retire from time to time, whether for a half hour or a month, to strengthen their forces and concentrate their feelings on the quest. In these retreats they need solitude to create their own mental atmosphere, freedom to obey the inner promptings of their spirit nature, and aspiration to relax, purify and ennoble their feelings. Periodical retirement from the uncertainties of worldly affairs to the certitudes of spiritual ones, from the distractions of city life to the peace of nature's solitudes, is an excellent rule. It is true that all feel at times the need of escape when overwork or overworry presses too much upon them or when too many contacts and too much bustle in cities make them look yearningly towards the country and towards solitude. At such times a respite from agitation is beneficial, indeed necessary. But, philosophy says, be reasonable with your retreat. Make it occasional in frequency and limited in duration. Go away from time to time but go away for a limited period only. Although philosophy approves of occasional retreats into quietist idleness as a temporary means to a wider end, it does not approve of quietist idleness as an end in itself. It never says find a permanent escape and remain a permanent escapist. A well-balanced life calls for a balanced form of retreat. It is just as effective to seek this and remain a layman as to spend all your life in escapist institutions and become a monk. It is not necessary to flee to monasteries for this self-training, anyone can practice it in his own home. Sometimes he can even practice it better for the opposition overcome, the difficulties mastered, will give him a tested strength which no monastery can give. Lecturing to an Athapindika, a multimillionaire of his time who wanted to renounce the world, the Buddha, arch-apostle of world renunciation though he was, said, I say unto thee, remain in thy station of life and apply thyself with diligence to thy enterprise. It is not life, wealth and power that enslave men, but the cleaving to life, wealth and power. When a man is concerned about lifelong retreat from the world, he may be obedient to a genuine inner need which at that particular stage will make for his true progress. But he may also be obedient, not to genuine need, but to a timid fear of becoming entangled in the affairs of troubled mankind. In that case, he has merely transferred his selfishness from a positive to a negative state. His virtue, having had no strain upon it, becomes a cloistered enfeebled thing. Where occasional withdrawal into retreat for longer periods is quite impossible, withdrawal every day into retreat for shorter periods is seldom impossible. They may be anything from 15 minutes up to a whole day. They offer a chance to take a beneficent vacation away from everyday routines and worldly distractions. The adventure of meditation, in this energetic era, anyone who places a high or higher value on the practice of relaxation and meditation, is likely to be thought either a fool or a fanatic. It is one of the chief delusions of modern men, caught in urban maelstroms, that if they were to make these daily pauses in life, they would lose something because of the time lost from their affairs. On the contrary, if the pause is real and sincere, they would gain something in the very sphere in which the supposed loss would occur. Simply to introduce short intervals of the fullest relaxation in the daily regime of personal activity is enough to yield markedly beneficial results. Under the pressures of modern civilization, they are a biological need. Any man will do more and better work, will feel less fatigued and conserve more vitality if he replenishes his forces by such rearrangement of his hours. Thus, he loses nothing in actuality by losing these few minutes from his labors and pleasures. He needs these oases in the desert of life's journey. Thought and feeling should welcome these brief beautiful deliverances from the burden of common existence. Yet the sad irony is that so many people are too preoccupied with worries to spare time for that which could help them better to bear their worries. It is to their own loss that they have no desire to relax or to meditate. And could they understand the deeper phases of spiritual life, they would understand that the common notion that no activity of the body means nothing done or gained, is falsified by the gratifying results of meditation. The less common notion that no activity of the intellect means the same profitless result is falsified by the unforgettable results of contemplation. Incidentally, these two are not the same but lower and higher stages of the same practice. We may now see what profound wisdom hid behind the ancient religious lawgiver's injunction to keep a weekly sabbatical day of rest. These wise men of antiquity considered ways and means of reminding man of his true purpose on earth. He was apartment to become wholly entangled in earthly desires and physical matters, and to forget what should be his supreme desire or the discovery of, and communion with, his divine soul. This is why they instructed him to substitute spiritual affairs and transcendental business for them, why they instituted a special day in the week for the purpose. He was recalled every seventh day to the higher object of all this work, the ultimate end for which it was only a temporary means. He was to be serious and even grave, to put frivolity aside for this one day because death was an ever-present shadow. A day of rest let his depleted surface consciousness lie fallow only to be all the more fruitful later. It gave the deeper levels of mind a chance to present their intuitive knowledge and it turned thought towards the sacred ultimate purpose of all human life. The same need or duty is even more urgent in this 20th century of ours. For modern invention, which could be used to bestow more leisure for spiritual pursuits, is actually used to defeat this aim. With the aid of automobiles, trains and even airplanes, and with the facilities provided by amusement and sports places, the Sabbath day is spent in transient pleasures. Such a day should be marked by the rededication of life to the loftiest accepted ideal and to the restatement of faith in its essentially spiritual character. It is the proper time to consider the future, to reflect upon the past and consequently to make advisable changes in thought, plan and practice. It is the time for a man to re-inspire himself with basic attitudes. On that day he is to enter into prayer, think about ultimates, reflect about aims, remember aspirations, read inspired books and practice meditations. He is to re-estimate his worth as bearing something divine in his heart. He is, finally, to consider and become conscious of the relationship which exists between himself and God. The flow of everyday living in work or leisure ordinarily distracts the mind from its higher purpose and keeps it moving from subject to subject. This continuous dissipation of the self's psychical energies and vital forces prevents any withdrawal of attention being concentrated in the endeavor to come to itself. The attempt to save a certain number of minutes out of the day's 24 hours for the sole purpose of reversing the flow of attention, turning it from restlessness to repose and from the senses to the soul, is the most important any man could engage in. He who excuses himself on the grounds that he cannot find even this short period, should ask his conscience whether all his ordinary activity in both work and leisure is really as necessary as it seems. If his conscience affirms that it is, if he can do no more, then it will be enough to maintain the right attitude towards external affairs and to keep constantly in the background of his mind the thought of the spiritual quest. Yet the truth is that few are really in such an unfortunate situation. No man may rightly say that he has had a full experience of life if he has not had any spiritual experience during life. If he is to become better balanced, Western man should not only give himself to active life but also to contemplative life. Exercises in meditation should be given a definite and assured place in Euro-American habits. Mystical practices should no longer be confined to a few persons and therefore considered to be abnormal, eccentric or queer. They should be brought into use by a wider group. Whoever will devote a period of his day to them and will support them by an honest effort to reform his way of life, may one day feel within himself the presence of a purer individuality, a spiritual self. This daily habit of excluding the personal affairs from attention or detaching them from emotion, of holding the mind remote from the trivialities, the temptations and the frictions of the world, while letting it sink deeper into abstraction, leads it to get and enjoy a tranquilizing respite of freedom from the pressure of life, work and people. The man who learns the art of retiring within himself to touch, not the darker strata of the ego's subconscious, but the deepest part of spiritual being, learns to possess both restfulness and happiness at his command. To the extent that he digs more deeply into his mind, he either finds benedictory powers of healing and pacification. A prefatory of such silent contemplation radiates its mood and spirit into the rest of his day. The more interior degrees of the mind's own being are the degrees nearest to the over-self. It is because of this fact that the value of mystical meditation is unique, for it draws the meditator's consciousness more and more inwards, more and more to the divine state that is its kernel. So long as the mind searches in regions alien to it, so long will the world's ultimate secret elude it. For the first step which the primordial cosmic mind took was outward into world manifestation, and this points out the inward direction in which our own last step must go, that is, within the mind itself. The human mind is everlastingly curious. It wants to know more and more, yet it can never finally slake this curiosity and satisfy this craving. All that it gathers is finite and limited, incomplete and insufficient, and must remain so. When at last it wakes up to this fact, it will sooner or later put itself upon the quest. Then, when it finally succeeds in turning around and gazing within, it will be stilled in, and become questionless with, an infinite satisfaction. We see things around us but not the light which renders the act of seeing possible. We experience the movement of thoughts but not that which renders this movement possible. For just as we must presuppose the existence of light in order to see a thing, so we must presuppose the existence of mind in order to know a thought. So long as the individual consciousness is entirely wrapped up in gazing at this pictorial presentation which it calls the world, so long will it be unconscious of its own being, so long will it remain an undisclosed mystery to itself. We do not know that the same thoughts which make up the world of our transient experience, at the same time keep us from the world of eternal reality. This is why the need of mystic withdrawal from them is a paramount. The aim of meditation, when culminating in contemplation, is the stilling of all mental activity so that mind itself, the source and condition of this activity, may be known in its original state. The practice ultimately leads the artist to find beauty and the mystic to find the godlike within himself. This is its highest purpose. Thus it leads them from materialism to mentalism, which teaches the truth about matter and unveils the reality behind its manifold appearances. There is a mind in man, immeasurably superior to his ordinary mind. If, in quiet moments and still moods, he will patiently wait its promptings and submit to them, if in these utterly relaxed reveries he will wait watchfully yet positively until the over-self reveals its presence to him, he may gain understanding, power and guidance immeasurably superior to what he ordinarily knows. Strength runs wild without wisdom and calmness to direct it. The complementary truth is that knowledge is dumb unless it is put into action. The squatting figure of the yogi seated in tranquil meditation and resting under cooling palm fronds, silent and motionless as a stone, is fascinating to some harassed Westerners. He is a reflective witness and not an active player in the game of life. His eyes are set, half closed in a still glance, and his mind is held fast in a world where there are not troublesome questions and no worrying problems. But can the yogi bring this same detachment into the same busy turbulent kind of life which the average Westerner must live? That man comes nearer to sanity and a full balanced life who begins or punctuates or ends his day by sitting erect with folded palm or hands upon his knees, with quiet ordered breathing and with eyes half open or closed, and who fixes his thoughts for as long as he can spare upon the mind which is at once the sublime source and mysterious sustainer of his being, and who then deliberately draws moral strength and far-seeing vision from his moments of meditation in order to go about his daily business, be it in office or factory, law court or hospital, farm or ship, and if he seeks to do his work with efficient keenness and effective practicality, both he and the world will be gainers. He will have sufficient philosophic detachment to discern in the very midst of his external activities and earthly ambitions that they are as transient as foam. He will try to do his duty amid the world's bustle, and to do it well, but he will not neglect the higher duty which he learns from the stillness mystically hiding behind that bustle. He will discipline himself daily, but the source of such discipline being the over-self, it will more and more arise spontaneously and without effort or seeking. By this regime it will eventually be possible for him to reach a state wherein the hurts and harms of everyday life possess but little power to wound. Even mistakes will be immediately converted into opportunities for growth. Civilization will justify itself only when men of the world become mystics, and when at the same time mystics rediscover the world. In the kind of period in which we live today, dominated as it is by economics and politics, by materialism and by violence, mysticism is inevitably separated from worldly life. The quieter minds react from its noisiness by withdrawal from the cities. The gentler spirits react from its violence by withdrawal into solitude. The intuitional minds react from its materialism by withdrawal into study and contemplation. Mysticism can find no standing ground for itself and allies itself with escapism. But although driven now to do this in self-defense, it will eventually be driven to reverse this process, following certain events. When the climax of violence passes, when materialism sinks exhausted, mysticism will have to return to active service and its leaders will begin to feel the urgent guidance to work in the outer world. Then they will find a place for themselves in a society which, in its old dispensation, had little use for them. Then public life will be inspired by its revelations. When a fine Spanish contemplative, Street Teresa, finally penetrated the enchanting glamour of her own mystical experience, she remarked, "This is the end of that spiritual union, that there may be born of its working, works." What she found in the course of her own development foreshadowed what will be found eventually in our own century by intelligent mystics, as contrasted with self-centered neurotic ones. They will have to form precise and clear ideas as to the practical implications and social values of mysticism during a time of world upheaval. The hour will indeed come for the extroverted man to get a fresh understanding of himself and at the same time to bring in a peace to his disrupted nerves. He has been questioning the whole universe for centuries. It is inevitable that he should also begin to question himself. It is hard to say, precisely and accurately, how anyone begins to know that this sublime power, the over-self, exists within him. The revelation is a compounded one. It consists of a metaphysical certitude, an intuitive feeling, and a mystical experience, all pointing to an indescribable something which alone, of all things, exists by its own independent right, which has as its very nature, causeless, eternal and perfect being. Take Jesus' statement that the kingdom of heaven is within you. The meaning of his beautiful words is transparent. He who looks for something ecclesiastical behind them is wasting time. They plainly bid each man to listen in silent reverie to the sublime intimations of his hidden being, that is, to practice mental quiet and enter into contemplation. Once he recognizes that the divine mind, wherever else it may also be in this infinite universe, is certainly within himself too, he ceases to wander in darkness and starts walking in light. God is then no longer an alien and remote being to be propitiated in abject fear or flattered in wheedling mendicancy, but a sublime ever-presence to be sought in his own heart and to be sought nobly in joy, reverence, humility and love. In the end, religious teachings about the soul must not only be founded on authentic personal experience of the leaders but must also lead to personal experience of the followers, or they will prove insufficient. The soul, this mysterious entity who is wholly non-existent to many people and whose quest is a chimera to most people, will eventually prove to be the only one who remains when all others pass away. If a man's thought is always directed towards the objects of his experience and never diverted towards the consciousness which makes that experience possible, then it is inevitable that those objects shall assume a significance and reality in and for themselves alone. That is to say, he will become a materialist. Yet the over-self is that out of which his own consciousness has come. Ought he not to give himself the daily spiritual chance to come in contact with it, with his most intimate self? he may travel the entire length and breadth of the five continents to commune with their cleverest scientists, but if he does not also travel within and commune with his own divine self, then the secret of life will still elude him. He misses what is most important if he misses going into the invisible temple of his own heart. There the soul abides, there the ray of God strikes the individual, and there alone the satisfying discovery of what he really is may be made. This is the fundamental tasker to become aware of the divine that is in him. All others are secondary and tertiary. He must establish himself in the consciousness of the over-self by and for himself. No other man can do it for him. And the quest's labor in purification and meditation is indispensable for this purpose. A practical relaxation exercise, the meditation practices have been described in some of this writer's earlier books, The Secret Path, The Quest of the Over-Self, and The Wisdom of the Over-Self, and those descriptions need not be duplicated here. But it has become advisable to remind readers again of the warning given in those works. They should make clear to themselves that spiritualistic mediumship is not in any way a goal to be sought by philosophic aspirants, and that if their meditation practice shows signs of leading to such a result, it should be dropped. They are not ready, and should apply their endeavors in the direction of self-betterment. The indiscriminate practice of exercises in psychical passivity and negativity and mediumship by people who know little or nothing about the forces they are evoking, is to be deplored. But in a different way, the same criticism must be applied to those who dabble in mystical exercises without reference to the moral laws and manifold conditions governing mysticism. Meditation is merely a part of the total approach needed in the quest of the over-self. The work upon proper balancing up of the psyche, upon strengthening character and eliminating negative traits, is even more important. For it is both a safeguard to ensure correct results and a means to avoid needless sufferings. When intelligence, common sense, judgment and discrimination are lacking, while neurotic emotions, hysterical tendencies and personal egoism are strongly present, when little or no attempt is made to discipline character, to cast out destructive feelings like anger and hate, the powers which may be unfolded by meditation may prove more harmful than beneficial. Such perils are then courted as nervous breakdowns, hallucinations, inflated self-esteem and insanity. Hence it was laid down in the ancient yoga manuals that purification should precede or accompany meditation. The practical techniques of the relaxation practices have not been given out before, and the core of them may now be briefly pictured. The student can begin them by adopting a more restful attitude towards people and events generally. This is a matter of imbibing a little philosophy. Then he can go on to the exercise proper, throwing his body flat on its back in a supine posture, closing its eyes and conserving all its muscular and nervous energy. The body and mind mutually interact. A relaxed body tends to induce a relaxed mind, just as an excited mind tends to induce restlessness of body. Relaxation will give him the tonic he needs and the repose he requires. But to put the body into a more receptive state, the exercise should be prefaced by deep and rhythmical breathing, done as soon as the student lies down on his back. His hands should lie loosely interlocked on the solar plexus. The air is a carrier of life force, and a change in the manner of its intake affects the body and removes fatigue very quickly. This rhythmic exercise requires an inhalation to be made silently and very slowly, counting 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. As he exhales, he should mentally repeat the same count. It is this consistency of measured balanced rhythm which draws vitality from the air into the body and harmonizes its functions. He should saturate the mind itself in this rhythm. In time the lungs will follow it automatically, and attention will be so immersed as to become unified with it. The breaths should be long, deep, slow and even, not jerky and not strained. The slowing down of respiration should result in a lessening of tension. A few minutes of this preliminary practice should spread the vitality in a rippling pattern through the whole body. He should think of the one life force pervading the entire universe, existing everywhere, filling all space, containing and permeating all creatures, including himself and all humanity. He should then imagine it being drawn in from space around the head, then flowing evenly and rhythmically down the right side of the head, the side of the trunk and down the right leg, then up the left leg, left side and back to the head again. This circular flow should be repeated a few times, letting the current rest in the head for a while at the end of each circuit. No part of the body is to be left out of the beneficial flow. All this is done with closed eyes. The next step is to lift both arms and let them flop down abruptly by their own weight as if they have suddenly gone dead. This is to be repeated with the legs. Then he is mentally to examine the whole body from head to foot. He will find that some muscles are unconsciously contracted and tensed. He should free them from such contraction wherever found and from tenseness of nerves wherever felt. The limbs should be comfortably slack. He should take special care to loosen any tightness in the hands and spine, and to relax the knot of muscles between the shoulders and the nape of the neck. The perfect human example of repose is the sleeping babe. Civilized habits of living have brought artificiality. Modern clothes, furniture and methods of work have interfered with and even perverted the natural ways of reposing self. They contract the muscles when there is absolutely no need to do so, thus wasting energy and running down the bodily battery. A useful supplementary practice for anyone engaged in continuous labor, or mental activity, is suddenly and deliberately to take a minute or two out of each hour, if he is free to do so, and to spend them in the supine posture, utterly limp and completely withdrawn from whatever he happens to be doing. When this is impossible, a brief mid-morning and mid-afternoon break of the same motionless kind will be the next best help. The amount of energy conserved by reverting to this relaxed state between working efforts may be infinitesimal at any given moment, but it becomes quite considerable when measured on the scale of months and years. What the undisciplined man unwittingly wastes in unnecessary or excessive contractions of certain muscles, and in exaggerated movements of the whole body, let alone an unconscious fidgeting of the hands or feet, shows how greatly he is victimized by bad habits. The exercises in relaxation may also be used when faced with many kinds of problems. A mind overwrought by some troubling event or by nervous fatigue may gain a better approach if it resorts to this limp and lifeless posture and at the same time makes the body's breathing rhythmic and slow, or if it takes these short stimulating periods of respite from such oppression. If he runs into any of life's manifold difficulties, causing anxiety, fear or distress, the student should practice the physical technique whenever that is possible, or the mental technique of relaxing into complete calmness, when it is not. He should suspend all judgment upon the situation and remember that to manifest fear, for instance, is really to pass judgment. He must pause from all consideration of the matter and let it go mentally until he can grasp the first emotional fruit of the successful practice of relaxation, which is a large reduction in moods of fear, worry or anger. The application of these techniques to a difficult or threatening situation is not a form of escape. That a man should look its facts squarely in the face, is an obvious philosophic counsel. But he should not look at them while he is panicky, terrified or too upset to see the best way out. Rather ought he to look at them after the relaxation practice has calmed down his nerves and feelings, restored his poise, shaken off his tensions and strengthened his judgment. He will then certainly be stronger and serener, hence better able to deal with them. He may even be wiser, in which case, he will be more confident and more courageous too. Nothing will be lost in regard to time, for with such an approach he will be able to make decisions more quickly and begin necessary actions more rapidly. In the case of that prolonged relaxation which is sleep itself, it would do every man nothing but good if he surveyed his day's activity at its nightly end and asked himself, as Pythagoras advised his disciples to ask, "What have I done? What have I left undone that I ought to have done?" The results of this interrogation should be made use of in renewed attempts at self-discipline. It is an equally useful practice to use the first few minutes after awakening for self-examination or self-preparation. It is a good time to give a little thought or however little to putting himself into harmony before starting again and carrying on with the routines of the day. All that has been written heretofore about the freeing of emotion and thought from negative qualities and about their training in meditation and relaxation, has been intended to lead to a spiritual result. This preliminary process is inescapable in most cases for the attainment of such a result.